Okay, good evening, everyone. Thank you all for joining us. It's a great honor, pleasure to have you all here. I'm just turning off my cell phone, if you wouldn't mind doing the same. On behalf of my father and my entire family, Jill and myself, it is an honor to welcome you all to the 15th annual Yahrzeit Memorial Lecture for my mother, Ruth Wiles, Aleha Shalom. Thank you all for coming. Your presence here tonight means a great deal to us, to our family, and to everything that we do here at MGE. Before I have the honor of introducing our guest speaker, I want to first recognize the presence, besides, of course, my father, Avi Marie, but to recognize the presence of Rabbi George and Freda Finkelstein, who happen to be in from Israel, and are gracing us with their presence tonight. Rabbi Finkelstein is a very dear friend, rabbi to our family. He's the executive director of the Great Synagogue in Jerusalem, and was someone my mother also admired greatly. And it means a lot to us to have you here, Rabbi and Rebbitzin. We are privileged this year to hear from... I also want to just welcome, also and recognize the presence of Chazan Malavani, Cantor Malavani from Fifth Avenue Synagogue, where we have our East Side programming, and all the other distinguished MGE rabbis and Chazanim, Rabbi Arni, Rabbi Pini, Rabbi Avi, that are here tonight. This year, we have a real treat to be able to hear from an incredible rabbi and close friend of our family. But before I call on Rabbi Rosenblatt, I just want to share a brief word with you about Pesel Avigail Bat Menachem, Aleha Shalom, my mother, in whose memory we decided 12 years ago to dedicate MGE. In just 2 weeks from tonight, we'll be lighting our menorahs, Hanukkah. And on the surface, it may appear that Hanukkah candles are just more candles. We light every Friday night the Shabbat candles, so we're adding more for a different holiday. But in truth, the Shabbat candles and the Hanukkah candles represent very different concepts. The Talmud tells us that we light Shabbat candles Mishum Oneg Shabbat, in order to rejoice in the Sabbath, and because of Shalom Bayis, peace in the home. And that somehow by illuminating our homes and actually benefiting from the light that we have in our homes, we will rejoice that much more in the Shabbos and in the kind of tranquility that we try to create every weekend in our Jewish homes. That's different than Hanukkah. Hanukkah candles are very different because we don't really light them to benefit from their illumination. In fact, one of the things that we say after we light the menorah, in the Hanerat Halalu prayer, we say, Ve'ein lanu reshut lihishtamesh bahem, and we don't have permission to utilize them, Ela lirotam bilvad, but rather just to look at them. And that is because the purpose of lighting the menorah is pursuma nisa, it's publication, it's publicizing the holiday. And that's why we try to put the menorah on a windowsill or someplace that others outside of our home can see it. And so whereas the Shabbat candles are really being lit to create a certain spirit within our home, to illuminate ourselves and our families, we light the Hanukkah candles to publicize and to share that spirit with those on the outside. My brother Michael and I, he's on his way. I'm usually the late one. We're blessed to be raised in a home with both of these kinds of lights. We had the Shabbos candles. And we had a certain aura of spirituality that emanated from my mother. She was a deeply religious woman who instilled within us a love for Torah, for Yiddishkeit, And at the same time, she was also concerned with those outside of our home. And so we had candles for the house, and we had candles sort of for those outside of our home. And she took a tremendous interest and was extremely devoted, as much as she was to us, at sometimes to other people. There was an elderly gentleman, I remember telling this story after she passed away, bachelor who lived in one of the projects in Forest Hills where we're from, always very meticulously dressed. I never saw him without a three-piece suit. I once actually visited him in his home. He was alone. He was wearing a three-piece suit. And he had a lot of dignity and a lot of pride. And at the age of around 80, he suffered from a heart attack. And he survived. And he was doing okay physically, but he didn't have the money to hire an assistant. And so there were members of our congregation of the Queens Jewish Center that would bring food over, offer him just some companionship. But nobody could get through. He was just very closed and had just a lot of dignity and pride and didn't want to accept other people's attention. Rabbi Grumblatt, should live and be well, our rabbi from Queens, called my mother and asked if she could try to get through. My mother showed up the next morning on this gentleman's doorstep in his apartment with a New York Times in one hand and a bouquet of flowers in the other. And she asked if she could come in. And he let her in, and she began to speak, and they began to talk. And after a few minutes, she asked if it would be okay if she drew the curtains, if she could bring some light into the apartment. And she was very, very respectful of his sense of dignity, of meticulousness. And he allowed her to cook for him a meal. And I remember she was telling me that there couldn't be too much salt in it. And she ended up arranging, I remember, with one of the local eateries, if you remember, Shores on 108th Street in Forest Hills, to get this gentleman the kind of food he needed on a regular basis. And eventually she was able to get him to our home for Shabbos. And he started opening up, and he started talking to us. And my brother and I began a relationship with him. And it was like he was alive again. And I remember thinking, you know, that my mother brought this, on some level, brought this man back to life. And she was very, very special like that. We've tried each year to commemorate her life by bringing in someone that she truly admired. And my mother loved Rabbi Rosenblatt, who is our guest speaker tonight. And she was very happy that he took an interest in me at a time that it was kind of trying to find myself. I met Rabbi Rosenblatt a little less than 20 years ago up at Yeshiva University, where I was a student in Rabbi Finkelstein's yeshiva, an MTA, and later in Yeshiva College. And then I used to see Rabbi Rosenblatt learning in the Beit Midrash in the morning, then I'd see him later on in the afternoon up at Columbia, where we were both in graduate school. And he was already the rabbi of the Riverdale Jewish Center, and I figured he was too busy to hang out with me, but somehow he found time, and we used to go play racquetball. And I became part of the racquetball young rabbis that got some very wonderful attention from a very, very special man. I was coached in everything from dating to learning, and he was always there for me and for our family. When my mother took ill, Rabbi Rosenblatt served as a tremendous support for us. He would often come and visit my mother, who loved to see him. He was there to dance at our wedding, and he was there to help us through her passing. And just 3 years ago, when Jill's father passed away, he came to be with my sons, with Yosef and with Ezra, to help them through this difficult time. He's a tremendous scholar and teacher, was ordained at Yeshiva University, and has a PhD in modern British literature from Columbia, but his greatest quality, in my mind, is his warmth and his humanity and his extraordinary ability to be there for people, whether it's his congregation, his students, or his friends. Rabbi Rosenblatt has now been serving for 26 years as the rabbi of the Riverdale Jewish Center and has mentored countless young rabbis who continue to turn to him for guidance and inspiration. And he models an important and serious commitment to Torah together with a very unique openness and appreciation for the world around us. And that approach has greatly impacted me and the work that I've been involved here in MGE over the last 12 years. Much of the community building and the kind of openness and warmth that many of our participants that I'm proud to say we have here at MGE comes from the influence of Rabbi Rosenblatt and for his special love for all Jews, irrespective of their affiliation or background. And it is truly an honor to have him here with us tonight to share some words of inspiration and of Torah in my mother's memory. Without further ado, it's my honor to introduce my teacher and my friend, Rabbi Jonathan Rosenblatt.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Mark. I can't tell you how much it means to me to have a few moments of public manifestation of what has been a warm and precious friendship, more years than I believe I could have counted. Connection with Rabbi Mark and with Michael, Amy and with Jill, and especially with a very precious friend, Leon. You know, this is a very important week. The Beatles finally made it to iTunes. And they say that means something in history. And there are those who think that, you know, Leon's subtitle is, because he was once John Lennon's lawyer. I don't know who makes the decision about who goes into whose Wikipedia article, which is kept in the heavenly computer. But in my Wikipedia, John Lennon is just a footnote. As someone who was lucky enough for a few brief years to know Leon Wilds. Because I don't know who else John Lennon knew in his life. I suspect that a huge percentage of them were card-carrying phonies. But I can certify in his behalf that he knew at least one real gentleman. And that's more than a lot of people get in this life. L'havdil bein ha'chaim u'bein ha'chaim. One doesn't just remember Ruth Wilds, aleha shalom. One feels a palpable sense of warmth in that memory. And recently I went home to see my mom, and I went to the cemetery where my dad and my grandparents, aleihem shalom, rest. And I was with a friend, and we were dedicating a monument to her dad. And she needed some quiet time, and so I wandered around the Beis Olam in Baltimore. And in the course of that wandering, came across so many old friends, the people who had been my shul buddies during the formative years of my life. And what was remarkable to me was that one had only to pass into the proximity of their matseva to feel rekindled the sense of unjudgmental love and generosity, and the teaching and the smiles. I went especially to my first Candyman, In those days, candy men were much more decorous and rigid than they are today. Now they seem to work on commission, so the more they... I don't know, in my shul, shopping bags are not just for Simchas Torah. Every Shabbos, kids go home with a kind of a dental orgy. In my day, there was one candy man, and for each child, there was one candy. Mark probably thinks I grew up during the Depression. This candy man stood about 5 feet tall. I went to his monument and made sure to greet him and wish him well, because that was almost a Pavlovian reaction, since in my shul, unless you said Good Shabbos nicely to Mr. Finson, you didn't get your candy. It wasn't some kind of a constitutional right just because you were short. He's the man who taught me to look into a person's eyes and say, Good Shabbos. And I went and thanked him. And for those few moments, I was that little boy again, suffused with the warmth of that experience. Well, I wasn't quite that young during the years when I knew Ruth Aleha Shalom. But I can say, without exaggeration, that the privilege of being here with you to remember her brings back exactly the same kind of suffusing warmth. She was a remarkable confluence of great faith and great creative generosity. That's really what Mark was talking about. Ruth would think to do things for people that other people may have done had they thought of it, but no one thought the way she did. And I am so grateful, especially when I see these beautiful young men growing up, to be one of the witnesses, to testify how blessed are the genes that they carry. I think I should introduce my topic just a bit, because, well, I tend to give these sort of flowery, poetic topics and hope sometime to make good on what the heck I was thinking when I said that. Usually, by the time I actually get around to giving the speech, I'm totally incapable of telling anyone what I was really thinking of, because it's kind of left my mind. But I've tried to hold on to this one. I wrote a few notes. And what I mean by building palaces on shifting sands is that we are a people who begin with certain axiomatic beliefs. We believe that God chose our people for an eternal mission. We believe that when He gave us the Torah, He envisioned all of eternity and a place for that Torah and that people in each of those generations. Hence, the notion that the Torah has somehow become outdated, that it is trapped in the amber of history, like some kind of an immortalized mosquito, is not part of our belief system. However, there are times when the world truly changes. And I'm not talking about changes in fashion. I'm talking about the kind of changes that turn the pages in the book of human anthropology. Movements from hunter-gatherer to farmer. Urbanization, the Industrial Revolution. The big ticket items. And the big difference between the ancient world and the modern is that the categories of time and place have exchanged places. Once upon a time, because human travel was so difficult and so limited, to go to the other side of a mountain was to engage another world which was truly a different world. A different language, a different culture, a different belief system, different economy, etc. Time? What was time? Things didn't change that fast. And generation after generation on the same land, around the same villages, had a sense of sweet, sleepy stasis. Recitation of Kaddish goes back to a time when it was assumed that an orphan would be sitting in his father's seat in the same synagogue and would sit there until he relinquished it to his heir. If you wanted to see change, you traveled in space. In the modern world, space has become almost irrelevant. Real business travelers sometimes have to check the board not to find out where they're going, but to figure out where they are, because all the airports feel exactly the same. Not only the airports, but the hotels. If one more city claims to have done urban renewal by installing the same insipid shops that are in every other urban renewal in the world, it's maddening. How many body shops does the universe need? I like lotion. You like lotion. Starbucks Ugarit. If you want to travel, if you want to see a different world, wait 5 years. If you wait 20, you will be completely disoriented. Rip Van Winkle only has to take a nap for an hour in this world, and you find yourself in another. And almost without fail, not in space, but in time, when one encounters a new world, suddenly the traditions that we carry and we axiomatically hold to be eternally relevant look strange and out of place. That sounds like a negative thing. But I would argue, as we begin this little journey tonight, which I hope you will not experience as either pessimism or alarmism, I believe it goes back to our very origins. Hafoch bo v'hafoch bo dekulo bo. There is little in the way of human, essential human experience that cannot be found already in the Torah. Only you have to be sensitive to this shift in the place of time and the place of space. Yaakov Avinu, this week's Parsha, returns from the house of Laban. The man who went alone comes with an almost completely exfoliated family, and he's about to encounter his father. God has instructed him to the return to the work of altars and offerings, which he has abandoned since the time he left his land. And he looks at his own children. Yomer Yaakov el beisov el kol asher imo hasiru es Elohei hanechor asher besochechem. Vihitaru v'achlifu simloseh. Get rid of your strange gods that are in your midst and purify yourselves, assume of some terrible pollution, and change your clothes for God's sake. And then we'll go up to Beis El and there I will make an altar. Is it conceivable that Yaakov Avinu, for a period of almost 2 decades plus, has been allowing his family to conduct itself with idolatrous practices. That in every pocket, in every bag, is another pagan god? Did he really think that he was exempted from the service of the one true God of his grandfather, Yaakov Avinu, the man we are told has his face engraved on the divine throne itself? I think the answer is very simple. When Yaakov Avinu was in Choron with his father-in-law, he did everything he had to do to raise a devout family in the tradition of Abraham. His children were distinct, certainly from all of their friends. Everybody knew that the children of Jacob did not play the way the children of the other children, the sons of Laban, played. They didn't go on the same schedule. They didn't eat the same food. They were a frum family. All of a sudden, he comes to Eretz Yisrael. And it's as if they're in a different world. And what in Laban's house was a harmless toy is suddenly a ghastly reminder of polytheism, of corrupted morals. And he tells his children, we are now in a different world. And we need to make an adjustment. The same thing, it maybe argues, happens many years later. In that moving reunion, the confrontation for the first time between Joseph and Jacob, when the patriarch who has longed for his son and the son who has longed for his father are finally reunited. And mysteriously the verse ends, Vayeshk al Savarov Od, one of them wept, and one of them did not. And the Mefarshim debate, who was not weeping? Was it the father who saw the son who had been his Ben Zekunim, his Bar Hakima, his the child of his wisdom, his perfect replica in faith, rendered Egyptian? Or was it the son who saw the father whom he remembered as a lion of truth, Titen Emes Liakov, suddenly an old and perhaps ever so slightly naive and primitive old man? Perhaps Joseph regrets that he has been reunited with his father and would have preferred to keep him as he was in his imagination, as he watched over him and allowed him neither to perish in glory nor in disgrace. What I'm saying is that in the new world, in Egypt, everything looked different, both from Joseph and Jacob's point of view. And so, we should not be per se frightened when we find ourselves in a new moment in history. When we find that we are in a new world, and it's a little bit difficult to get traction. It's a little bit difficult to serve the objectives of eternity in a landscape which we hardly recognize. I would like to address three different areas, merely as illustrations. Three areas which I think any of us would stipulate without argument are central to the transmission of Jewish identity as defined by the Torah. One, the Sabbath. Two, the family. And three, the unique identity of the Jewish people, and connected to it, the unique relationship with the land of Israel. I think we could fairly well agree at this point, unless someone has a moving argument, that in all of Jewish history, no one has succeeded in creating perpetuity of generations minus any of these elements. And yet, I think that on each of these fronts, we are facing a rapid and in some ways unexpected and certainly unprepared for erosion. Let's talk about the Shabbos. What I am seeing pastorally is an acceleration of an abandonment of the laws of the Sabbath, even in families who have been Sabbath observers for 3 and 4 and 5 and in some cases unbroken chains of generations going back as long as anyone remembers. Families that survived the trials of the immigrant period, of the Great Depression, people who literally lived on the edge of starvation rather than to break the Sabbath. And that goes without even beginning to include families who a generation ago, or perhaps two, made the decision to return to a meticulous level of observance. And their children or grandchildren, who have been given in many cases the benefits of the best in day school education at monumental expense per child, have lived in communities surrounded by other observant people. You can't say they were isolated. Growing up in fine, highly reputed synagogues. And yet, I am seeing a growing snowball of youngsters who, as early as junior high and high school, whether they've made the decision or merely acquired the habit, are abandoning Shabbos. Why? I think the answers are not simple, but they all go back to the issue of a different world. What is it that is bringing down Shabbos? Once upon a time, observing Shabbos was focused on the 39 forbidden categories of labor. These 39 categories, loosely abstracted, meant that man, the Creator, took a one-day leave from His creation, became, as it were, passive, in order to acknowledge the mastery of the universe by the great Creator, the large C. The challenge to Shabbos is no longer creation. The youngsters who abandon are not abandoning in favor of carpentry or leatherwork or factory jobs. In this moment in civilization, it is not creation but communication which is the irresistible magnet. The ubiquity, of electronic communication, of text messaging, of the cell phone, of Facebook, of Twitter. You know these. You know the litany better than I. I'm old. Has made it such that the abandonment of electricity as a means of communication feels like near paralysis. It is experienced by youngsters like a 25-hour period with a gag in their mouth. And other factors feed into this as well. For what once upon a time caused Jews to reluctantly abandon the observance of the Sabbath was the need to work, anxiety over labor, and it's a paradox that Hashkama Minyan in many communities has become the refuge of the quietly, religiously elite. You know, if you're really frum, you go to the Hashkama Minyan. Hashkama. It means that if you hear a rabbi speak more than 4 minutes, you break out in hives. The Hashkama Minyan was not born in Frumkeit. It was born for people who needed to quickly daven on Shabbos morning and then go to work. That's who populated the Hashkama Minyanim. But you see, our anxiety is no longer about work. We have an equal and opposite anxiety about leisure. You know what the scariest question you can ask a high school student is? So what are you doing Saturday night? Saturday night is a trial by fire. To be someone who is not doing something is social immolation. And the organization of who's going to be doing what with whom is a question that holds terrible anxiety. My own daughter in high school once pulled me to the computer after Havdalah. And you can tell when you go on the computer what time everybody logged in, and showed me the children in her classes and of the neighborhood and what time they went on the computer. The computer's clock, don't lie. And it means that any youngster who waits till after Havdalah will find that all of the musical chairs of social survival have already been occupied. And so the temptation to close the door and be connected to what, when you are an adolescent, is life itself is a tremendous pressure. I don't remember this, but I remember Sundays making my mother's life miserable. Day off. I remember the script. And I was a decent kid, you know. I didn't give my parents too much trouble. Except on Sunday. This is my only day. Am I not going to do anything? The idea of coming to Sunday evening with nothing to show for it but your homework was a catastrophe. It was like missing your birthday. It was like being sick on Purim. It was like the fourth night of Hanukkah when you got socks. Who said one night had to be sensible? I'm sorry we don't have elves. I would have that elf executed. And we were so good. We had to pretend we liked every present. You know, feet pajamas. when you're 14? You know what I'm saying? It was embarrassing. Every night you said, oh, dear Lord, let this not be the night. And then you just sort of knew by the shape of the thing your mom brought out of the closet. You go, oh, boy. Take a deep breath and prepare to smile. People think that rabbis are very good at pretending to be happy all the time. I learned it on Hanukkah. It had nothing to do with the rabbinate. Pajama night. Oh, boy. Gee, this is fun. Let's sing Moz Tzur again. Yaha. In addition to these challenges of the Shabbos, the pull of the moment of leisure truth, we have other issues that collide. Number one, we suffer, and you'll see this in a number of areas, from monogenerationalism. People who are trained that you can only be friends with people exactly your age. Not younger, not older. Right? Basically, anyone more than 6 months older than you who wants to be your friend is probably a pervert. That is the sickness with which we have irradiated. And you know where it's coming from. It's coming from the people who want to keep us carefully demographied so that they can sell all the people in the room the same product. It's like if you're watching television for an hour and a half, at least when I am, and most of the ads are for those scooters to get around your own house, you get the feeling you might be on the wrong channel. They don't want you to hang out with anybody too different. So what do? We have this thing called Shabbos. And we occasionally ask our children to sit at a table with, you should pardon the expression, adults. And have, you should pardon of the expression, a conversation. Could anything be more unnatural to their experience? How can you have a conversation anyway without texting it across the table? See, in our shul, I especially like Purim. I know he's here somewhere. On Purim, Mr. Brahman is now able to text me that we're 4 minutes over time. So when I feel my belt begin to vibrate, I just wave across the shul. But, and then there's the problem. What's the worst, the truly worst conceptual obscenity in the life of, well, not just young people, most of us. Those of us who are multitaskers, who can't do anything unless we're doing three things. You remember when reading a book was enough? In my house, you get the book, you open it up, and you go, where's my iPod? It's like, where's my eyeball? You don't just do one thing. Because the great boogeyman is boredom. This is boring. And generations raised on instant various stimulation and entertainment, it is very hard to slow down to the speed of the things which compose a sweet, lovely Shabbos afternoon. Not easy to curl up with just a book, or to take out a board game, or to actually play a game of imagination with your friends or your siblings. And so, suddenly the Shabbos is something very difficult to attach to. The family. Family is a very hard thing to keep together. unfortunately, in our society, what kept, traditionally, what kept marriages together? It wasn't love. It wasn't even a sense of shared equity. To a certain extent, it was social stigma. It was the idea that for a marriage to end meant being a kind of a pariah, or at least the object of pity. I remember in my class in elementary school, there was one young man whose parents were divorced. And for us, in the second, the third grade, he was exactly the same as an orphan. In our society, even in the Orthodox world, unfortunately, the simple common occurrence of divorce has made it an easier option, in some cases perhaps for blessing. In many cases, especially for the children, the great heartbreak. I have to say this is completely politically incorrect. Yesterday, someone came over to me and said, "Rabbi, what do you think of the Aguna problem?" I said, "I think it's a terrible shame." "Well, I want to write a book about it." I said, "Okay, write a book." I said, "But when you write the book, why don't you put it in context and talk about the pressure on the whole family structure and the roles of family and the roles of men and women in society. Because I read a great deal more about the plight of Agunot, which is certainly a serious problem, than I read about the children of all of the marriages which had nice, agreeable gittin. I don't see too many organizations for them." And 25 years later, I spent a lot of time picking up their pieces. There's a lot of broken hearts out there. You know that West Side phenomenon of commitment challenged? Some of the people who are commitment challenged is because they're not sure that a marriage for keeps can ever work. Because they are those children. But it goes beyond that. Talk about a new world. I heard an interesting study lately which says that Homo sapiens, in case you didn't know that's us, leaped forward ahead of the Neanderthals, who were our immediate predecessors, somewhat slower and less intelligent, because we had a longer latency period. What that means is Neanderthals reached sexual maturity earlier, and Homo sapiens, in an interesting turn, usually in evolutionary biology, animals that mature quickly can breed quickly, and it's good for your evolutionary health. In this particular instance, because the mind was involved, that the extended latency period of the Homo sapien actually allowed the human race to become human because it had a little longer before it had to worry about sex and supporting children. We are in an interesting turn back of the clock, because what we are seeing actually is, I think, the rolling back of latency. And it's rolled back twice. Number one, it's rolled back biologically, because children are entering adolescence statistically earlier. This may have to do with hormones in the food or good nutrition. It's not my specialty. But even before biological adolescence, the same demographers of whom I spoke so lovingly before have young children already thinking
in the categories of mating dances long before the hormones are dancing. My particular bone to pick, I hate the Disney people. Nothing makes me sadder on Purim than the princess costumes. Sweet little things. You know what a princess is? A princess is some poor girl who's nobody till Aladdin says she is. Till the prince says she has some value. They're nothing more than the junior league of prostitution. Objects. Worrying about mating gestures when they should just be playing. You see what goes on in the malls? Now I would like to know how those little girls actually get into those jeans. More than that, I'd like to know how they manage to exhale. I know hot dogs that have roomier skins than some of that denim. And like poor Dina in the Parsha who goes, she says to look at the daughters of Shechem. These young kids are parading around and becoming spectacles. Why? Well, because sexuality is the ultimate commodity, the ultimate trophy in our society. And they have special pressure in this crazy world in which they live, because now, with a change in the rules, the people who waited for their rewards until they were financially successful, because they don't have to necessarily stay married to their original partner, like some calf which has already passed through the Meiser line and jumps back into the corral. Not only do you have fathers competing with sons for the same young women, you know what a cougar is? Now you have mothers competing with their daughters for eternal sexual value. In that world, what did we count upon to keep people in role, to keep people in some kind of a structure ruled by decency and morality? Well, for one thing, we counted upon community standards, that old fallback shame, self-respect. Well, the internet has rendered that absolutely irrelevant. Because the world's second great leap into privacy has taken place in our generation. You know when the first one was? Cultural historians? It is not an accident that the invention of indoor plumbing corresponds with the great flowering of French pornographic postcards. This is just social history. The creation of privacy. You know what? Do you know the difference between a house built in 1900 and the house built in 2000 is? Surveyed by architects? Our houses have closets and bathrooms in place of dining rooms and guest rooms. Because the two things you want are privacy and stuff. You need closets for stuff and bathrooms for privacy. And who's going to come under your roof anyway with all your stuff and all your privacy? And so we are a community. If we have any dream of preserving some kind of a traditional family structure, we are in a different world and we are embattled. Everywhere we turn, the rug is being pulled out from under us. And one more area before I make the most modest suggestion. To be a Jew. To believe that the Jews need to exist. That our presence in the world is not only a product of divine will, but is a blessing to the family of man. In a world where the claim that one belongs to a particular group with a sense of pride and commitment and with discrete boundaries is always greeted with suspicion that you have somehow embraced racism or elitism, that you are flying in the face of the universal democratic spirit of the enlightened liberal world, saying that you're Jewish and plan to marry a Jew, saying that you are Jewish and would like to live in a Jewish neighborhood. For a very wide spectrum of our community is politically incorrect. You can be as Jewish as you want as long as you don't imply that anyone else, including your spouse and your children, should feel any particular overwhelming need to be that. And this extends certainly to the land of Israel, to the state of Israel. The very words "a Jewish state" in some circles ring as a neo-obscenity. But did he have you with them? I was invited to a wedding where the groom, not from far away, told his parents he would not allow "Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim," "If I forget thee, O Jerusalem," to be sung under his chuppah, because he thought it was connected with political bigotry. And make no mistake, particularly the modern Orthodox community, which is committed to the notion that authentic Torah Judaism is not only possible but required in every historical moment and circumstance, that one does not have to freeze time and crawl into a bubble in order to be not only viable but authentic. Authenticity and contemporaneity are for us always linked, because each age has presented challenge, and it is from those challenges that creativity itself emerges. And the fact that we live in a world which is embarrassed by Jewishness, embarrassed by a Jewish state, embarrassed by a tradition which is bimorphic, and by which I mean has roles for men and roles for women. The fact that the notion of role itself has become uncomfortable means that things very dear to us, existentially required by us, are under siege. And it is not a matter of what sex will be the clergy. This is part of a much deeper
sense of embarrassment, the traditions and the very existence of our people. Now that sounds, I'm afraid, so far like some kind of a Jeremiad. It sounds like we're beaten in the starting gate, that we should fold up our tents or else hide our heads in the sand. And I think nothing could be further from the truth. Because you see, we also believe that our tradition holds within it certain elemental magic, that the Creator who made this thing called man also gave us his book. And in that book would speak to us of how to be in every circumstance. I don't think the read is going to be an easy one. I must tell you, there's a famous midrash where it says that God taught the Torah to Moses and he promptly forgot it. Tried again, couldn't hold on to it. 49 times God taught Moshe the Torah and he came up empty, and on the 50th time he gave it to him as a gift. Now, the way that is usually read is that Moshe Rabbeinu was a less than promising natural scholar. He just wasn't that swift. He was not the brightest candle in the chandelier. He was not the sharpest tool in the shed. He was not the biggest club. And you get my drift. I don't think that's it at all. See, Moshe Rabbeinu had just met God. Moshe Rabbeinu had known in his sinew that extraordinary transformative combination of awe and love. Moshe Rabbeinu's cells were on fire in the presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam in the most direct, undiluted communication that any human being had ever experienced. And then God said to him, I'm going to make myself available. You could find me in this book. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, oh, that's good. Show me the book. Looks in the book. What's the book? The book has got stories about people waited a well for a shidduch. It's got stories about oxen goring other oxen. And did they do it before? They didn't do it before. It's got lists of how old people were when they had their kids and how old they were when they died. Moshe Rabbeinu said, I don't think so. You sure you gave me the right book? I read the book. I didn't feel nothing. I know what it's supposed to feel like. I read this book. It's a good book. But nobody's going to tell me you read it. He said, read it again. I read it again. The 50th read. Kadosh Baruch Hu winked to the angels. Moshe Rabbeinu read the book. And he began to tremble. And he said, He is in the book. And that's when he was allowed to come down and become our teacher. We believe that he's still in the book, you see. But we have to respond to what the world is and figure out how we're going to make that real. We're not going to have 49 chances. We have to get it right. So I think one of the things we have to recognize is that, especially since the Second World War, American Jewry, which became the Jewry, what was our magic? We specialized in Jewish institutions.
We created the day school movement. We took the synagogue to being the Jewish center. We made it the core of all kinds of community activity. Subsequent to that, we reinvented the yeshiva and turned it into a religious finishing school where in case we didn't get them in the first 14 years, we could send them to Israel. And the makib patish, the final completing blow, would be rendered without fail by this magic institution of all institutions. What we are experiencing in our world is the fact that Jews are no longer creatable by what you put around them. By putting them in an institution and assuming that in that enclosed, sustained social experience, a smithy for the forging of a soul will be created. Because you see what's happened? In this world in which we live, people are not with the people in the room the way they used to be. I saw an article in the Daily News. It's the best thing about having physical therapy. I get to read magazines I wouldn't be caught dead reading under other circumstances. Hope there's no editor in the room. Oh my God, it's on tape. There's the libel suit. Happen to read. Columbia University is worrying because their students walk around and don't talk to each other. They're offering new incentives to people who will talk to strangers. I can make this up. Why? Because they walk around with their earbuds in. Who needs a real friend when your ear has a bud? Chobzim bud. And their what's the iPads and the iPhones? Scariest word in the world is apps. Apps. Apps means something else for you to do that doesn't involve anyone you know. You just slide them across. You can play catch with them, right? You can like, and they keep going until you stop them. I think it could be a new thing. Want to get people to bond. They could just play catch with their apps. But what it means is that the inner human being is living inside a new kind of wall. Because being with people doesn't mean being with people. And that means that in order for Jewish replication to take place, we have to be worried not about what kind of institutions people are in. We have to worry about institutions that find a way to put something inside people. Any youngster with two of the following three items, a credit card, a computer with internet, or a cell phone, is Superman. That child cannot be covered by enough surveillance. They can do whatever they want. And if they can't do it in your house, I guarantee you they can do it in the house of any friend they like. And since adolescence now officially goes to about age 53, there's an awful lot of people at risk. What does that mean? We should abandon our children. Abandon our children to the sewer? No. It means that we have to put things inside of kids. We have to talk from the assumption that they will have power, that they will have freedom. We have to stop worrying about the decisions and worry about the decision makers. If we want people to keep Shabbos. We have to ask ourselves how much of Shabbos is meaningful and relevant to them. Have we taught them how to taste Shabbos? Have we created the context of personal experience? Have we spoken someplace even deeper than where the text messages and the Facebook friends go? Can we make them safe in that place so that what we need to grow is in a soil beyond the reach of the temptations, is in a place where they feel God living? See, I'm an optimist. I believe that a large portion of the world will, for a while longer, continue trying to solve the new problems with the old solutions. People will continue trying to enroll their children in safety. They'll pick the right school and the right yeshiva and the right camp, and they will institutional guarantors that no one will get to their kid. And all they'll do is create a more and more sophisticated tribe of sneaks who can get by all the defenses. But someone will come along, someone's, and will say, we don't need to close our schools. We need to open them. We need to begin to run them according to the experience, the life experience of a child. We have to teach a child that the whole world is flashing pictures. How do you slow down enough to read a Mishnah? More than that, we have to figure out what they learn on the ball field and on the school bus ride, and how they treat the custodians. And in the shul, we have to ask ourselves, I see a lot of people reading, but is anybody praying? You see, in every generation, there are going to be a few people whom God will show, A, it's a new world. B, I'm still in it. Don't be afraid. Be bold. Take another look at your children. Help them drop their little idols and prepare them to worship at the altar. One of the greatest contributions of MJE was that when many in the outreach world had given up on the synagogue as a place that could ever make living Jews, Rabbi Mark Wild said, you're all wrong. There's nothing wrong with the synagogue if we know how to use it. I know how to bring people to the 10th floor and not just put Judaism around them. I think we can figure out how to put it in them. In them. So that they will open up the book and say, He is here. If God is still whispering in the ears of people like Rabbi Mark Wilds, then even in a strange new world, He has not forgotten us. There will be Jewish children. Jewish children who not only preserve, but insist, have the fire in their belly to transmit, and as long as there is a world, there will be Jews. And we will build our palaces not on shifting sand, but on stone. I don't know whether anyone is still awake, but I'd be happy to take questions.
send you all to watch Negelwasser, but that would involve an elevator ride, and by the time you watch Negelwasser, you have to daven Shacharis anyway. Are there any questions before I turn things over to... Yes? Could you say your name? Because
Adam.
Say the first name?
Adam.
Yes, Adam.
Even in some place without a synagogue, on business, you can have, you can study more with all these electronic devices. You can read more. And not carry all your encyclopedia program books with you because it's all on the computer.
Adam, you're 100% correct. The internet is a huge opportunity. I'm not, God forbid, I'm not asking to roll back history or to attempt, although it would be folly, to tell people that the internet is forbidden. I simply mean that youngsters have to be prepared to know what's out there, as opposed to trying to keep it away, and make sure that their explorations are indeed of the Torah sites. You're 100% right. There is more Torah available than there has ever been since it was given. Yes?
In no way challenges anything that you said, all of which I enjoy and value, but I just offer you a small anecdote that at least points the possibility of a different direction. And this is true. I am in a deeply involved in a business with a secular Israeli, and the business is in a situation that demands 22 hours a day of his attention. He has five children, seven and under, and he travels probably 4 days a week. He gets between 500 and 800 emails a day and has begun shutting off all of his electronics, including his BlackBerry, Friday afternoon and a few minutes before Shabbos, and he is discovering Shabbos and becoming immensely meaningful to him simply as an escape from technology.
Right, I think, and you know, one of what makes it interesting is that the new way will be led not by people who are the nachschleppers, who are sort of have one toe in the water. The new way will be led by people who have allowed themselves to be completely immersed and realize that the new world is not the Garden of Eden. And they will help us go to the next. That's one of the reasons, I think, frankly, that religious discourse has to almost eschew nostalgia as its main... as its main item in trade, to encourage people to try out the old way. I think religious discourse has to be at exactly that cutting edge of evaluating, of allowing our people to judge the landscape in the absolute most sophisticated terms so that we can make our way in it. And the time of the delicate rabbi who didn't drive a car. I think that's something of the past. I think we're good. Michael. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of my father, Leon Wilds, my brother, Rabbi Mark Wilds. This is actually the 15th year since my mother's passing. It's an amazing experience to see how time goes. My daughter Raquel, perhaps her most precious citizen here, just came late because she was at Ramaz at Israel night, contemplating whether she's going to go to Israel for the year and then off to college. Such a special experience to be here with Mr. Brodman and his BlackBerry, with Rafi Grunfeld and his guitar, who actually sang to my mother when healing was so spiritual, and he actually struck a chord. To see my uncle and my aunt, my wife, my brother, my sister-in-law, and so many wonderful people who have made the next leg of this journey so comforting, to know from Rabbi Finkelstein and others that have helped my mother actually mother and raise us in that effort would take the time tonight is endearing. My grandfather, Elder Shalom, my dad and my uncle's father, used to have his store open, Rabbi Rosenblatt, on the Shabbos. He would say Kiddush, and they would get to the store. They lived in a coal mining town, and they were afraid by the time Shabbos ended, they would have drank all of their wages. But it was important that they walked to the neighboring town to listen and to participate in the minyan, to make the minyan. He had to keep the store open. And at a time where it became just a measure of custom for him to keep the store open, it was my mother who approached my father and said, it's not good for our boys. The same DNA was in the family. My grandfather shut the store down that very first time when his son, my father, went to him. Because he didn't have to keep it. He thought this is what he was servicing in that community. See, spirituality was in my mother instinctively. Whether you got a shalach manos that was ordered, pre-wrapped, and arranged. In our house, Shabbos started on a Tuesday. That's normal. By Friday afternoon, you know, it was triage time. But that expansive, beautiful table, that eternal legacy that you so eloquently articulated this evening, Rabbi, is what I think my mother is still working for each of us here. But it's most exemplified and articulated here, in this city, and in this snapshot of time, by what my brother does. We joke that he's the Yaakov and I'm the Esav. From the politics to the rabbinate and everything in between, the service to others, the beautiful way that he endears himself to make a couple, keep a kosher home, to live by example and to keep the family from the youngest to the oldest intact, is part of that expansive DNA. In many ways, we still believe that our mother is still working for us. And to see this through, to ensure that there's another generation of Shabbos tables, I can't think of a more appropriate way. And I urge you, because of these economic times, to help this young man do his job. Because he's not doing it for his own benefit. Could have come into a law firm, could have made a lot of money, and we could have all been davening a different floor in this building, and they got to fix that elevator. That's awesome. But he chose to help others, and he does it with love. My mother never burdened somebody. She had high standards and was very disappointed when people didn't come to those standards. But she knew a good thing. She gave 110%, never expecting in return, and learned through the years how to expect less and always gave more. That's Mark. So give more, because you'll get more, and we will ensure, then, Rabbi, the solution to the challenge you faced us. Thank you, and I urge everybody to join us for some refreshments. God willing, we'll see you back next year.
Across the hall, some refreshments. Please enjoy yourselves. And there will be Maariv evening service in about 15 minutes, right back in this room. Thank you for coming.